The Lovely Bones, Disc 2.
Chapter 3. The odd thing about Earth was what we saw when we looked down. Besides the initial view that you might suspect, the old ants from the skyscraper phenomenon, there were souls leaving bodies all over the world. Holly and I could be scanning Earth, alighting on one scene or another for a second or two, looking for the unexpected in the most mundane moment. And a soul would run by a living being, touch them softly on the shoulder or cheek, and continue on its way to heaven. The dead are never exactly seen by the living, but many people seem acutely aware of something changed around them. They speak of a chill in the air. The mates of the deceased wake from dreams and see a figure standing at the end of their bed, or in a doorway, or boarding, phantom-like, a city bus. On my way out of Earth, I touched a girl named Ruth. She went to my school, but we'd never been close. She was standing in my path that night when my soul shrieked out of Earth. I couldn't help but graze her. Once released from life, having lost it in such violence, I couldn't calculate my steps. I didn't have time for contemplation. In violence, it is the getting away that you concentrate on. When you begin to go over the edge, life receding from you as a boat recedes inevitably from shore, you hold on to death tightly, like a rope that will transport you, and you swing out on it, hoping only to land away from where you are. Like a phone call from the jail cell, I brushed by Ruth Connors. Wrong number. Accidental call. I saw her standing there near Mr. Boat's red and rusted Fiat. When I streaked by her, my hand leapt out to touch her. Touch the last face. Feel the last connection to Earth in this not-so-standard-issue teenage girl. On the morning of December 7th, Ruth complained to her mother about having had a dream that seemed too real to be a dream. When her mother asked her what she meant, Ruth said, "I was crossing through the faculty parking lot, and suddenly, down out of the soccer field, I saw a pale running ghost coming toward me." Mrs. Connors stirred the hardening oatmeal in its pot. She watched her daughter gesticulating with the long, thin fingers of her hands, hands she had inherited from her father. "It was a female, I could sense that," Ruth said. "It flew up out of the field. Its eyes were hollow. It had a thin white veil over its body, as light as cheesecloth. I could see its face through it, the features coming up through it, the nose, the eyes, the face, the hair." Her mother took the oatmeal off the stove and lowered the flame. "Ruth," she said, "you're letting your imagination get the best of you." Ruth took the cue to shut up. She didn't mention the dream that wasn't a dream again. Even 10 days later, when the story of my death began to travel through the halls of the school, receiving add-on nuances, as all good horror stories do, they were hard-pressed, my peers, to make the horror any more horrible than it was. But the details were still missing. The what and when and who became hollow bowls to fill with their conjectures. Devil worship. Midnight. Ray Singh. Try as I might, I couldn't point Ruth strongly enough to what no one had found. My silver charm bracelet. I thought it might help her. It lay exposed, waiting for a hand to reach out. A hand that would recognize it and think, clue. But it was no longer in the cornfield. Ruth began writing poetry. If her mother or her more approachable teachers didn't want to hear the darker reality she had experienced, she would cloak this reality in poetry. How I wished Ruth could have gone to my family and talked to them. In all likelihood, no one but my sister would have even known her name. Ruth was the girl who got chosen next to last in gym. She was the girl who, when a volleyball sailed in her direction, cowered where she stood while the ball hit the gymnasium floor beside her, and her teammates and the gym teacher tried hard not to groan. As my mother sat in the straight-back chair in our hallway, watching my father run in and out on his various errands of responsibility. He would now be hyper-aware of the movements and the whereabouts of his young son, of his wife, and of his remaining daughter. Ruth took our accidental meeting in the school parking lot and went underground. She went through old yearbooks and found my class photos, as well as any activities photos like chem club, and cut them out with her mother's swan-shaped embroidery scissors. Even as her obsession grew, I remained wary of her, until that last week before Christmas when she saw something in the hallway of our school. It was my friend Clarissa and Brian Nelson. I dubbed Brian the Scarecrow, because even though he had incredible shoulders that all the girls mooned over, his face reminded me of a burlap sack stuffed with straw. He wore a floppy leather hippie hat and smoked hand-rolled cigarettes in the student smoking lounge. According to my mother, Clarissa's penchant for baby blue eyeshadow was an early warning sign, but I'd always liked her for just this reason. She did things I wasn't allowed to do. She lightened her long hair. She wore platform shoes. She smoked cigarettes after school. Ruth came upon the two of them, but they didn't see her. She had a pile of huge books she had borrowed from Mrs. Kaplan, the social science teacher. They were all early feminist texts, and she held them with their spines resting against her stomach so that no one could see what they were. Her father, a building contractor, had made her a gift of 2 super strong elastic book bands. Ruth had placed 2 of them around the volumes she planned to read over vacation. Clarissa and Brian were giggling. His hand was inside her shirt. As he inched it up, her giggling increased, but she thwarted his advances each time by twisting or moving an inch or two away. Ruth stood apart from this, as she did most things. She would have passed it in her usual manner, head down, eyes averted, but everyone knew Clarissa had been my friend. So she watched. "Come on, honey," Brian said. "Just a little mound of love. Just one." I noticed Ruth's lip curl in disgust. Mine was curling up in heaven. "Brian, I can't. Not here." "How about out in the cornfield?" he whispered. Clarissa giggled nervously but nuzzled the space between his neck and shoulder. For now, she would deny him. After that, Clarissa's locker was burgled. Gone were her scrapbook, random photos stuck to the inside of her locker, and Brian's stash of marijuana, which he had hidden there without Clarissa's knowledge. Ruth, who had never been high, spent that night emptying out the tobacco from her mother's long brown Moore 100s and stuffing them with pot. She sat in the tool shed with a flashlight, looking at photos of me and smoking more grass than even the potheads at school could suck down. Mrs. Connors, standing at the kitchen window doing dishes, caught a whiff of the scent coming from the tool shed. "I think Ruth is making friends at school," she said to her husband, who sat over his copy of the Evening Bulletin with a cup of coffee. At the end of his workday, he was too tired even to speculate.
"Good," he said.
"Maybe there's hope for her yet."
"Always," he said.
When Ruth tottered in later that night, her eyes bleary from using the flashlight and from the 8 more cigarettes she'd smoked, her mother greeted her with a smile and told her there was blueberry pie in the kitchen. It took a few days and some non-Susie Salmon-focused research, but Ruth discovered why she had eaten the entire pie in one sitting. The air in my heaven often smelled like skunk. Just a hint of it. It was a smell that I had always loved on Earth. When I breathed it in, I could feel the scent as well as smell it. It was the animal's fear and power mixed together to form a pungent, lingering musk. In Franny's heaven, it smelled like pure grade A tobacco. In Holly's, it smelled like kumquats. I would sit whole days and nights in the gazebo and watch, see Clarissa spin away from me toward the comfort of Brian, see Ruth staring at her from behind a corner near the home ec room or outside the cafeteria near the nurse's station. At the start, the freedom I had to see the whole school was intoxicating. I would watch the assistant football coach leave anonymous chocolates for the married science teacher, or the head of the cheerleading squad trying to capture the attention of the kid who had been expelled so many times from so many schools, even he had lost count. I watched the art teacher make love to his girlfriend in the kiln room, and the principal moon over the assistant football coach. I concluded that this assistant football coach was a stud in the world of Kennett Junior High, even if his square jaw left me cold. On the way back to the duplex each night, I would pass under old-time street lamps that I had seen once in a play of Our Town. The globes of light hung down in an arc from an iron post. I had remembered them because when I saw the play with my family, I thought of them as giant heavy berries full of light. I made a game in heaven of positioning myself so that my shadow plucked the berries as I made my way home. After watching Ruth one night, I met Franny in the midst of this. The square was deserted, and leaves began to swirl around in an eddy up ahead. I stood and looked at her, at the laugh lines that were clustered near her eyes and mouth. "Why are you shivering?" Franny asked. And though the air was damp and chilly, I couldn't say that that was why. "I can't help thinking of my mother," I said. Franny took my left hand in both of hers and smiled. I wanted to kiss her lightly on the cheek or have her hold me, but instead I watched her walk off in front of me, saw her blue dress trail away. I knew that she wasn't my mother. I couldn't play pretend. I turned around and went back to the gazebo. I felt the moist air lace its way up along my legs and arms, lifting, ever so slightly, the ends of my hair. I thought of spider webs in the morning, how they held small jewels of dew, how, with a light movement of the wrist, I used to destroy them without thinking. On the morning of my 11th birthday, I had woken up very early. No one else was up, or so I thought. I crept downstairs and looked into the dining room where I assumed my presence would be. But there was nothing there. Same table as yesterday. But as I turned around, I saw it lying on my mother's desk in the living room. The fancy desk with an always clean surface. The bill-paying desk was what they called it. Swaddled in tissue paper but not yet wrapped was a camera. What I had asked for with a tinge of whining in my voice, so sure they wouldn't get it for me. I went over to it and stared down. It was an Instamatic, and lying beside it were three cartridges of film and a box of four square flashbulbs. It was my first machine, my starter kit to becoming what I wanted to be, a wildlife photographer. I looked around. No one. I saw through the front blinds, which my mother always kept at a half slant, inviting but discreet, that Grace Tarking, who lived down the street and went to private school, was walking with ankle weights strapped to her feet. Hurriedly, I loaded the camera, and I began to stalk Grace Tarking, as I would, I imagined, when I grew older, stalk wild elephants and rhinos. Here I hid behind blinds and windows. There it would be high reeds. I was quiet. What I thought of as stealthy, gathering the long hem of my flannel nightgown up in my free hand. I traced her movements past our living room, front hall, into the den on the other side. As I watched her receding form, I had a brainstorm. I would run into the backyard where I could see her with no barriers. So I ran on tiptoe into the back of the house, only to find the door to the porch wide open. When I saw my mother, I forgot all about Grace Tarking. I wish I could explain it better than this, but I had never seen her sitting so still, so not there, somehow. Outside the screened-in porch, she was sitting on an aluminum fold-out chair that was facing the backyard. In her hand, she held a saucer, and in the saucer was her customary cup of coffee. That morning, there were no lipstick marks, because there was no lipstick until she put it on for... who? I had never thought to ask the question. My father? Us? Holiday was sitting near the birdbath, panting happily, but he didn't notice me. He was watching my mother. She had a stare that stretched to infinity. She was, in that moment, not my mother, but something separate from me. I looked at what I had never seen as anything but Mom and saw the soft, powdery skin of her face, powdery without makeup, soft without help. Her eyebrows and eyes were a set piece together. Ocean eyes, my father called her when he wanted one of her chocolate-covered cherries, which she kept hidden in the liquor cabinet as her private treat. And now I understood the name. I had thought it was because they were blue, but now I saw it was because they were bottomless, in a way that I found frightening. I had an instinct then, not a developed thought. And it was that, before Holiday saw and smelled me, before the dewy mist hovering over the grass evaporated and the mother inside her woke as it did every morning, I should take a photograph with my new camera. When the roll came back from the Kodak plant in a special heavy envelope, I could see the difference immediately. There was only one picture in which my mother was Abigail. It was that first one, the one taken of her unawares, the one captured before the click startled her into the mother of the birthday girl, owner of the happy dog, wife to the loving man, and mother again to another girl and a cherished boy. Homemaker, gardener, sunny neighbor. My mother's eyes were oceans, and inside them there was loss. I thought I had my whole life to understand them, but that was the only day I had. Once upon Earth, I saw her as Abigail, and then I let it slip effortlessly back, my fascination held in check by wanting her to be that mother and envelop me as that mother. I was in the gazebo thinking of the photo, thinking of my mother, when Lindsay got up in the middle of the night and crept across the hall. I watched her as I would a burglar circling a house in a movie. I knew when she turned the knob to my room, it would give. I knew she would get in. But what would she do in there? Already my private territory had become a no-man's land in the middle of our house. My mother hadn't touched it. My bed was still unmade from the hurried morning of my death. My flowered hippo lay among the sheets and pillows, and so did an outfit I'd discarded before I chose the yellow bell-bottoms. Lindsay walked across the soft rug and touched the navy skirt and red and blue crocheted vest that were two separate, heatedly despised balls. She had an orange and green vest made from the same pattern. She took the vest and spread it out flat on the bed, smoothing it. It was ugly and precious all at once. I could see that. She petted it. Lindsay traced the outline of the gold tray I kept on my dresser, filled with pins from elections and school. My favorite was a pink pin that said, "Hippy Dippy Says Love," which I'd found in the school parking lot, but had had to promise my mother I wouldn't wear. I kept a lot of pins on that tray, and pinned to a giant felt banner from Indiana University, where my father had gone to school. I thought she would steal them, take one or two to wear, but she didn't. She didn't even pick them up. She just swept her fingertips over everything on the tray. Then she saw it, a tiny white corner sticking out from underneath. She pulled. It was the picture. A deep breath rushed out of her, and she sat down on the floor, her mouth still open and her hand still holding the picture. The tethers were rushing and whipping around her, like a canvas tent come loose from its stakes. She too, like me until the morning of that photograph, had never seen the mother stranger. She had seen the photos right after. My mother looking tired, but smiling. My mother and Holiday standing in front of the dogwood tree as the sun shot through her robe and gown. But I had wanted to be the only one in the house that knew my mother was also someone else. Someone mysterious and unknown to us. The first time I broke through, it was an accident. It was December 23rd, 1973. Buckley was sleeping. My mother had taken Lindsay to the dentist. That week they had agreed that each day, as a family, they would spend time trying to move forward. My father had assigned himself the task of cleaning the upstairs guest room, which long ago had become his den. His own father had taught him how to build ships in bottles. They were something my mother, sister, and brother couldn't care less about. It was something I adored. The den was full of them. All day at work he counted numbers, due diligence for a Chad's Ford insurance firm. And at night he built the ships or read Civil War books to unwind. He would call me in whenever he was ready to raise the sail. By then the ship would have been glued fast to the bottom of the bottle. I would come in and my father would ask me to shut the door. Often, it seemed, the dinner bell rang immediately, as if my mother had a sixth sense for things that didn't include her. But when this sense failed her, my job was to hold the bottle for him. "Stay steady," he'd say. "You're my first mate." Gently, he would draw the one string that still reached out of the bottle's neck, and voila! The sails all rose, from simple mast to clipper ship. We had our boat. I couldn't clap because I held the bottle, but I always wanted to. My father worked quickly then, burning the end of the string off inside the bottle with a coat hanger he'd heated over a candle. If he did it improperly, the ship would be ruined. Or, worse still, the tiny paper sails would catch on fire and suddenly, in a giant whoosh, I would be holding a bottle of flames in my hands. Eventually, my father built a balsa wood stand to replace me. Lindsay and Buckley didn't share my fascination. After trying to create enough enthusiasm for all three of them, he gave up and retreated to his den. One ship in a bottle was equal to any other as far as the rest of my family was concerned. But as he cleaned that day, he talked to me. "Susie, my baby, my little sailor girl," he said. "You always liked these smaller ones." I watched him as he lined up the ships in bottles on his desk, bringing them over from the shelves where they usually sat. He used an old shirt of my mother's that had been ripped into rags and began dusting the shelves. Under his desk, there were empty bottles. Rows and rows of them he had collected for our future shipbuilding. In the closet were more ships. The ships he had built with his own father, ships he had built alone, and then those we had made together. Some were perfect, but their sails browned. Some had sagged or toppled over after years. Then there was the one that had burst into flames in the week before my death. He smashed that one first. My heart seized up. He turned and saw all the others, all the years they marked and the hands that had held them. His dead father's, his dead child's. I watched him as he smashed the rest. He christened the walls and wooden chair with the news of my death, and afterward he stood in the guest room den surrounded by green glass. The bottles, all of them, lay broken on the floor, the sails and boat bodies strewn among them. He stood in the wreckage. It was then that, without knowing how, I revealed myself. In every piece of glass, in every shard and sliver, I cast my face. My father glanced down and around him, his eyes roving across the room. wild. It was just for a second, and then I was gone. He was quiet for a moment, and then he laughed, a howl coming up from the bottom of his stomach. He laughed so loud and deep, I shook with it in my heaven. He left the room and went down the two doors to my bedroom. The hallway was tiny. My door, like all the others, hollow enough to easily punch a fist through. He was about to smash the mirror over my dresser, rip the wallpaper down with his nails, but instead he fell against my bed, sobbing, and balled the lavender sheets up in his hands. "Daddy?" Buckley said. My brother held the doorknob with his hand. My father turned but was unable to stop his tears. He slid to the floor with the sheets still in his fists, and then he opened up his arms. He had to ask my brother twice, which he had never had to do before. But Buckley came to him. My father wrapped my brother inside the sheets that smelled of me. He remembered the day I'd begged him to paint and paper my room purple. Remembered moving in the old National Geographics to the bottom shelves of my bookcases. I had wanted to steep myself in wildlife photography. Remembered when there was just one child in the house for the briefest of time until Lindsay arrived.
"You are so special to me, little man," my father said, clinging to him.
Buckley drew back and stared at my father's creased face, the fine bright spots of tears at the corners of his eyes. He nodded seriously and kissed my father's cheek. Something so divine that no one up in heaven could have made it up. The care a child took with an adult. My father draped the sheets around Buckley's shoulders and remembered how I would fall out of the tall four-poster bed and onto the rug, never waking up. Sitting in his study in his green chair and reading a book, he would be startled by the sound of my body landing. He would get up and walk the short distance to my bedroom. He liked to watch me sleeping soundly, unchecked by nightmare or even hardwood floor. He swore in those moments that his children would be kings or rulers or artists or doctors or wildlife photographers. Anything they dreamed they could be. A few months before I died, he had found me like this, but tucked inside my sheets with me was Buckley, in his pajamas, with his bear curled up against my back, sucking sleepily on his thumb. My father had felt in that moment the first flicker of the strange, sad mortality of being a father. His life had given birth to 3 children, so the number calmed him. No matter what happened to Abigail or to him, the 3 would have one another. In that way, the line he had begun seemed immortal to him, like a strong steel filament threading into the future, continuing past him no matter where he might fall off, even in deep, snowy old age. He would find his Susie now inside his young son, give that love to the living. He told himself this, spoke it aloud inside his brain. But my presence was like a tug on him. It dragged him back, back, back. He stared at the small boy he held in his arms.
"Who are you?"
he found himself asking.
"Where did you come from?"
I watched my brother and my father. The truth was very different from what we learned in school. The truth was that the line between the living and the dead could be, it seemed, murky and blurred. Chapter 4. In the hours after I was murdered, as my mother made phone calls and my father began going door to door in the neighborhood looking for me, Mr. Harvey had collapsed the hole in the cornfield and carried away a sack filled with my body parts. He passed within 2 houses of where my father stood talking to Mr. and Mrs. Tarking. He kept to the property line in between 2 rows of warring hedge, the O'Dwyer's boxwood and the Stead's goldenrod. His body brushed past the sturdy green leaves, leaving traces of me behind him, smells the Gilbert's dog would pick up and follow to find my elbow. smells the sleet and rain of the next 3 days would wash away before police dogs could even be thought of. He carried me back to his house, where, while he went inside to wash up, I waited for him. After the house changed hands, the new owners tisk-tisked at the dark spot on the floor of their garage. As she brought prospective buyers through, the realtor said it was an oil stain. But it was me, seeping out of the bag Mr. Harvey carried and spilling onto the concrete. The beginning of my secret signals to the world. It would be some time before I realized what you've undoubtedly already assumed, that I wasn't the first girl he'd killed. He knew to remove my body from the field. He knew to watch the weather and to kill during an arc of light to heavy precipitation, because that would rob the police of evidence. But he wasn't as fastidious as the police liked to think. He forgot my elbow. He used a cloth sack for a bloody body. And if someone, anyone, had been watching, maybe they would have thought it strange to see their neighbor walk a property line that was a tight fit, even for children who like to pretend the warring hedges were a hideout. As he scoured his body in the hot water of his suburban bathroom, one with the identical layout to the one Lindsay Buckley and I shared, his movements were slow, not anxious. He felt a calm flood him. He kept the lights out in the bathroom and felt the warm water wash me away, and he felt thoughts of me then. My muffled scream in his ear, my delicious death moan, the glorious white flesh that had never seen the sun, like an infant's, and then split so perfectly with the blade of his knife. He shivered under the heat, a prickling pleasure creating goosebumps up and down his arms and legs. He had put me in the waxy cloth sack and thrown in the shaving cream and razor from the mud ledge, his book of sonnets, and finally the bloody knife. They were tumbled together with my knees, fingers, and toes, but he made a note to extract them before my blood grew too sticky later that night. The sonnets and the knife, at least, he saved. At Evensong, there were all sorts of dogs, and some of them, the ones I liked best, would lift their heads when they smelled an interesting scent in the air. If it was vivid enough, if they couldn't identify it immediately, or if, as the case may be, they knew exactly what it was, their brains going, steak tartare, they'd track it until they came to the object itself. In the face of the real article, the true story, they decided then what to do. That's how they operated. They didn't shut down their desire to know just because the smell was bad or the object was dangerous. They hunted. So did I. Mr. Harvey took the waxy orange sack of my remains to a sinkhole 8 miles from our neighborhood, an area that until recently had been desolate save for the railroad tracks and a nearby motorcycle repair shop. In his car, he played a radio station that looped Christmas carols during the month of December. He whistled inside his huge station wagon and congratulated himself. Felt full up. Apple pie, cheeseburger, ice cream, coffee. Full. Better and better he was getting now, never using an old pattern that would bore him, but making each kill a surprise to himself. A gift to himself. The air inside the station wagon was cold and fragile. I could see the moist air when he exhaled, and this made me want to palpate my own stony lungs. He drove the reed-thin road that cut between two new industrial lots, the wagon fishtailed coming up out of a particularly deep pothole, and the safe that held the sack that held my body smashed against the inside hub of the wagon's back wheel, cracking the plastic. "Damn!" Mr. Harvey said, but he picked up his whistling again without pause. I had a memory of going down this road with my father at the wheel and Buckley sitting nestled against me, one seatbelt serving the two of us, in an illegal joyride away from the house.
My father had asked if any of us kids wanted to watch a refrigerator disappear. "The earth will swallow it," he said. He put on his hat and the dark cordovan gloves I coveted. I knew gloves meant you were an adult, and mittens meant you weren't. For Christmas 1973, my mother had bought me a pair of gloves. Lindsay ended up with them, but she knew they were mine. She left them at the edge of the cornfield one day on her way home from school. She was always doing that, bringing me things. "The earth has a mouth?" Buckley asked. "A big round mouth, but with no lips," my father said. "Jack," my mother said, laughing, "stop it. Do you know I caught him outside growling at the snapdragons?" "I'll go," I said. My father had told me that there was an abandoned underground mine, and it had collapsed to create a sinkhole. I didn't care. I liked to see the earth swallow something as much as the next kid. So when I watched Mr. Harvey take me out to the sinkhole, I couldn't help but think how smart he was. How he put the bag in a metal safe, placing me in the middle of all that weight. It was late when he got there, and he left the safe in his wagoneer while he approached the house of the Flanagans, who lived on the property where the sinkhole was. The Flanagans made their living by charging people to dump their appliances. Mr. Harvey knocked on the door of the small white house, and a woman came to answer it. The scent of rosemary and lamb filled my heaven and hit Mr. Harvey's nose as it trailed out from the back of the house. He could see a man in the kitchen. "Good evening, sir," Mrs. Flanagan said. "Got an item?" "Back of my wagon," Mr. Harvey said. He was ready with a $20 bill. "What you got in there? A dead body?" she joked. It was the last thing on her mind. She lived in a warm, if small, house. She had a husband who was always home to fix things and to be sweet on her because he never had to work. And she had a son who was still young enough to think his mother was the only thing in the world. Mr. Harvey smiled, and as I watched his smile break across his face, I wouldn't look away.
"Old safe of my father's. Finally got it out here," he said. "Been meaning to do it for years. No one remembers the combination."
"Anything in it?" she asked.
"Stale air."
"Back her up, then. You need any help?"
"That would be lovely," he said.
The Flanagans never suspected for a moment that the girl they read about in the papers over the next few years, missing, foul play suspected, elbow found by neighboring dog, girl, 14, believed killed in Stolfa's cornfield, warnings to other young women, township to rezone adjoining lots to high school, Lindsay Salmon, sister of dead girl, gives valedictorian speech. Could have been in the gray metal safe that a lonely man brought over one night and paid them $20 to sink. On the way back to the wagon, Mr. Harvey put his hands in his pockets. There was my silver charm bracelet. He couldn't remember taking it off my wrist, had no memory of thrusting it into the pocket of his clean pants. He fingered it, the fleshy pad of his index finger finding the smooth gold metal of the Pennsylvania keystone, the back of the ballet slipper, the tiny hole of the minuscule thimble, and the spokes of the bicycle with wheels that worked. Down Route 202, he pulled over on the shoulder, ate a liverwurst sandwich he prepared earlier that day, then drove to an industrial park they were building south of Downington. No one was on the construction lot. In those days, there was no security in the suburbs. He parked his car near a porta-john. His excuse was prepared in the unlikely event that he needed one. It was this part of the aftermath that I thought of when I thought of Mr. Harvey, how he wandered the muddy excavations and got lost among the dormant bulldozers, their monstrous bulk frightening in the dark. The sky of the earth was dark blue on the night following my death, and out in this open area Mr. Harvey could see for miles.
I chose to stand with him, to see those miles ahead as he saw them. I wanted to go where he would go. The snow had stopped. There was wind. He walked into what his builder's instincts told him would soon be a false pond, and he stood there and fingered the charms one last time. He liked the Pennsylvania keystone, which my father had had engraved with my initials. My favorite was the tiny bike. And he pulled it off and placed it in his pocket. He threw the bracelet, with its remaining charms, into the soon-to-be man-made lake. 2 days before Christmas, I watched Mr. Harvey read a book on the Dogon and Bambara of Mali. I saw the bright spark of an idea when he was reading of the cloth and ropes they used to build shelters. He decided he wanted to build again, to experiment as he had with the hole, and he settled on a ceremonial tent like the ones described in his reading. He would gather the simple materials and raise it in a few hours in his backyard. After smashing all the ships in bottles, my father found him there. It was cold out, but Mr. Harvey wore only a thin cotton shirt. He had turned 36 that year and was experimenting with hard contacts. They made his eyes perpetually bloodshot, and many people, my father among them, believed he had taken to drink. "What's this?" my father asked. Despite the salmon men's heart disease, my father was hardy. He was a bigger man than Mr. Harvey, so when he walked around the front of the green shingled house and into the backyard, where he saw Harvey erecting things that looked like goalposts, he seemed bluff and able. He was buzzing from having seen me in the shattered glass. I watched him cut through the lawn, ambling as school kids did on their way toward the high school. He stopped just short of brushing Mr. Harvey's elderberry hedge with his palm. "What's this?" he asked again. Mr. Harvey stopped long enough to look at him and then turned back to his work. "A mat tent?" "What's that?" "Mr. Salmon," he said, "I'm sorry for your loss." Drawing himself up, my father gave back what the ritual demanded. "Thank you." It was like a rock perched in his throat. There was a moment of quiet, and then Mr. Harvey, sensing my father had no intention of leaving, asked him if he wanted to help. So it was that from heaven, I watched my father build a tent with the man who'd killed me. My father didn't learn much. He learned how to lash arch pieces onto pronged posts and to weave more slender rods through these pieces to form semi-arches in the other direction. He learned to gather the ends of these rods and lash them to the crossbars. He learned he was doing this because Mr. Harvey had been reading about the Amezereg tribe and had wanted to replicate their tents. He stood, confirmed in the neighborhood opinion that the man was odd. So far, that was all. But when the basic structure was done, a one-hour job, Mr. Harvey went toward the house without giving a reason. My father assumed it was break time, that Mr. Harvey had gone in to get coffee or brew a pot of tea. He was wrong. Mr. Harvey went into the house and up the stairs to check on the carving knife that he had put in his bedroom. It was still in the nightstand, on top of which he kept his sketch pad, where often in the middle of the night he drew the designs in his dreams. He looked inside a crumpled paper grocery sack. My blood on the blade had turned black. Remembering it, remembering his act in the hole, made him remember what he had read about a particular tribe in Southern Air. How when a tent was made for a newly married couple, the women of the tribe made the sheet that would cover it as beautiful as they could. It had begun to snow outside. It was the first snow since my death, and this was not lost on my father. "I can hear you, honey," he said to me, even though I wasn't talking. "What is it?" I focused very hard on the dead geranium in his line of vision. I thought if I could make it bloom, he would have his answer. In my heaven, it bloomed. In my heaven, geranium petals swirled in eddies up to my waist. On Earth, nothing happened. But through the snow, I noticed this. My father was looking toward the greenhouse in a new way. He had begun to wonder. Inside, Mr. Harvey had donned a heavy flannel shirt, but what my father noticed first was what he carried in his arms. A stack of white cotton sheets.
"What are those for?"
my father asked. Suddenly, he couldn't stop seeing my face.
"Tarps," Mr. Harvey said.
When he handed a stack to my father, the back of his hand touched my father's fingers. It was like an electric shock.
"You know something," my father said.
He met my father's eyes, held them, but didn't speak. They worked together, the snow falling, almost wafting down. And as my father moved, his adrenaline raced. He checked what he knew. Had anyone asked this man where he was the day I disappeared? Had anyone seen this man in the cornfield? He knew his neighbors had been questioned. Methodically, the police had gone from door to door. My father and Mr. Harvey spread the sheets over the domed arch, anchoring them along the square formed by the crossbars that linked the forked posts. Then they hung the remaining sheets straight down from these crossbars so that the bottoms of the sheets brushed the ground. By the time they had finished, the snow sat gingerly on the covered arches. It filled in the hollows of my father's shirt and lay in a line across the top of his belt. I ached. I realized I would never rush out into the snow with Holiday again, would never push Lindsay on a sled, would never teach, against my better judgment, my little brother how to compact snow by shaping it against the base of his palm. I stood alone in a sea of bright petals. On Earth, the snowflakes fell soft and blameless, a curtain descending. Standing inside the tent, Mr. Harvey thought of how the virgin bride would be brought to a member of the Amezereg on a camel. When my father made a move toward him, Mr. Harvey put his palm up.
"That's enough now," he said. "Why don't you go on home?"
The time had come for my father to think of something to say. But all he could think of was this.
"Susie,"
he whispered, the second syllable whipping like a snake.
"We've just built a tent," Mr. Harvey said. "The neighbors saw us. We're friends now."
"You know something," my father said.
"Go home. I can't help you."